Tonight we come to the third teaching. We finally made it. Last night was story night. We had the build-up to the third teaching, where the Buddha carefully selects his new audience. It was quite obvious that he was deliberately targeting Kassapa, the three Kassapa brothers, and their students. After this third discourse, where the 1,003 new bhikkhus all become fully awakened, by the way, then they keep going east and they go to Rajagaha, which is the capital of Magadha. And when all of the ascetics turn up at the capital city, all dressed differently and all with shaved heads instead of the dreadlocks, this, of course, provokes a great deal of interest. And so there's a big audience. And the audience notices that there's another person hanging out there who's not one of the former ascetics. And they wonder among themselves, so who's the student here and who's the teacher? And realizing what is going on, the elder Kassapa brother then gets down and publicly bows to the Buddha. He's the teacher. And so it's like the grand entrance into the capital city, and the Buddha's career in Magadha begins with a kick start. So you can see there's a certain amount of strategic thinking going on, and it's something about part of the nature of the Buddha as a personality which people tend to slide over if they think, okay, he's enlightened, so he's very spiritual and up there somewhere. So he must have been kind of floating around, just kind of vaguely being spiritual. Well, if that was the case, we would not have a Buddhism today. It would not have survived. The reason why we're sitting in a hall with a Buddha image doing this practice is because the Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, had a very shrewd political mind. He knew how to build an international institution that lasted, and that's why it survived. So that side of him is very significant. So we've had a look at the beginning of the discourse. This is the Buddha takes the ascetics away from their normal territory. He doesn't teach them there. He takes them to this hill. Now, this is South Bihar. It's completely flat. At the mountains, you get mountains at the south, where it's basically where Bihar ends and they move into the southern states, the Deccan. So it's a very flat terrain. And the Buddha takes them to the local highest point, probably quite deliberately, that he goes up to the closest they've got to a mountain. And he teaches them, he says, "Bhikkhus, everything is burning." And what is this everything that is burning? The eye sensitivity is burning. Visual forms are burning. Visual awareness is burning. Visual contact is burning. And whatever feeling arises dependent upon visual contact, whether pleasant or painful or neither painful nor pleasant, that too is burning. Burning with what? Burning, I declare, with the fire of obsession, with the fire of aversion, with the fire of delusion. Burning with birth, aging and death, with sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. The ear sensitivity is burning. The nose sensitivity is burning. The tongue sensitivity is burning. The body sensitivity is burning. The mind sensitivity is burning. Phenomena are burning. Mind awareness is burning. Mind contact is burning. And whatever feeling arises dependent upon mind contact, whether pleasant or painful or neither painful nor pleasant, that too is burning. Burning with what? Burning, I declare, with the fire of obsession, with the fire of aversion, with the fire of delusion. Burning with birth, aging and death, with sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. So that's the beginning of the discourse, the first section of it. It's quite brief, that's about half of it. Now, first of all, burning. The theme clearly is fire. Why does the Buddha emphasize this image of fire? he's dealing with, his audience are essentially shamans. And he's, the image is fire, but the subject matter is the immediacy of sense experience. This is what he's talking about, the sense fields. For the Buddha, there are six senses, i.e. nose, tongue, body, mind. The Buddha counts mind as a sense organ. We don't do that in our culture. When we talk about the senses, we mean the five physical senses. We usually don't talk about the mind as a sense. When we say the sixth sense, we mean something spooky and paranormal and so on. When the Buddha is talking about the sixth sense, he's talking about mind as a sense organ. Because what is a sense organ? A sense organ is a particular kind of sensitivity. There's the body is sensitive. If certain kinds of stimuli strike it, boom, then something happens. If it's registered in some way. So the first one is the eye. There's part of the body is sensitive to light. Most of it isn't. So this part, for example, is not. And this part isn't. And this part here, that's not either. But this part is sensitive to light. So there's a particular kind of sensitivity in the body. In the world, there's a particular form of object or stimulus. The stimulus strikes that particular part of the body, that sensitivity, and something happens. And the something is what the Buddha calls contact or passa, which represents the immediacy of experience, the very moment that an experience takes place. Passa could also be translated, it's usually translated contact, it could also be translated as stimulus. So it's all about stimulus. So and so there are five physical forms of stimulus that the human body takes. The next second one, sound. Now again, there's one part of the body that is sensitive to sound waves. This part isn't, but that part is. So sound waves strike the sensitivity. There's a stimulus, and something happens, an experience takes place. Same with the nose, with smells, tongue, tastes, body. So here, the whole package is sensitive to touch, and internal and external. So there's this package of sensitivity, and this package of sensitivity is receiving data all of the time, being stimulated all of the time. Mind is also a sensitivity. The objects or that strike against it are not physical. But have you ever been burdened by thought? Have you ever felt a thought rushing in? Have you ever seen anything in your mind which wasn't there physically? Like if you close your eyes, can you imagine your house, for instance? Could you imagine the voice of your partner? So the mind contains within it certain objects which strike a particular sensitivity. Now this sensitivity is unique. It's not physically located. It doesn't seem to have a specific location. We would put it in the brain. In fact, often when I hear on the radio or whatever discussions about mind, people will use the term brain and mind interchangeably in our culture. But this is not what the Buddha's talking about. He's talking about an experience, a particular sensitivity which is not physical, which is struck by something, and something happens when that sensitivity is disturbed or struck in some way. So we have the senses. And this is the world of experience. anything that happens to us comes through these. There's stimulus, and where there is stimulus, there's response. And the response, of course, is feeling. So when the Buddha talks about the six senses, he invariably talks about feeling. So he says, mind sensitivity, phenomena. Phenomena here is dharmas. It's a technical term meaning that which impacts upon the mind sensitivity. Phenomena, mind awareness, mind contact, and whatever feeling arises dependent upon mind contact. So as soon as you have a stimulus, then it contains affect. It'll be registered as either pleasant, painful, or neither, and as a result, there'll be a response. So if it's pleasant, grab. If it's painful, getting out of here. If it's neither, either dunno, so ignore it, or don't know what to do about it. So this discourse is about the intimacy of experience and the response to that. This is what the subject of the discourse. Why does he teach this to the dreadlocks ascetics? I think because of their shamanic background and the practices that they did, as we saw in the stories about them, they lived a life in which they were very intimate with the elements. Fire, water, cold, rivers, forests. Their shamanic practices sound like, you know, maybe a touch extreme, but certainly very physical and very intimate with the elements. Like, coldest time of the year, let's head into that river for our ceremonies. And so on. So they're people who what we would call live in nature. Like, they're very sensitive to what's going on in terms of the immediacy of their experience. Their practice was very powerful and very direct. But from the Buddha's perspective, it was severely limited. This is why he critiqued it. And there were two things that immediately are obvious about why the Buddha would look at their way of practice and think, nah, this is not it. First of all, possessions. They did a lot of ritual, a lot of ceremony, and they needed particular forms of equipment in order to do the ceremonies. So if you didn't have all the accoutrements for the fire ceremony, for the water ceremony, and so on, you couldn't do it. So you couldn't, you know, rouse up the spirits that you're trying to rouse up. And secondly, it's dependent upon places. They're very much concerned with spirits, communicating with them, bringing them forth, probably being inhabited by them. You know, you can imagine various things I might be getting into. But the thing about these spirits, and this is certainly the case in the Indian tradition, but you see it all over the world, the spirits are limited by location. A spirit lives in a particular location. So you go to a particular forest glade, and there's a spirit that lives there, not in the glade just over the hill, but this one. You go to a particular stretch of the river, a particular spirit is strong there. And that's probably why all three brothers were basically camped along the same stretch of river. This particular stretch of this particular river was sacred to the spirits that they had a connection with. Probably there might have been three Naga brothers, it's quite possible. But each Kassapa brother had a shrine for a particular Naga spirit. And it's possible that these spirits are also brothers. And apart from that aspect, they also, because of their rituals, they needed certain supplies. They needed wood, lots of it apparently, because of the sacred fire, so they had to be close to a forest. And they needed water, because of their ceremonial bathing. So they needed, they were limited by certain forms of equipment and certain places. Given these conditions, they could do their practice. You look at the Buddha's approach to practice. First of all, no equipment is necessary. Absolutely none. I mean, we have a certain amount. We have nice cushions and so on, because we're not used to sitting on the floor. But in ancient India, people sat on the floor routinely. People didn't have furniture. So if someone said, there's a piece of ground, sit there and meditate, for anybody, it wouldn't be a big deal. You must sit down and make yourself comfortable. But no special equipment is required. And any place is suitable. You don't need a particular place. You can do it anywhere. The Buddha's Buddhism as a religion and the Buddha's way of practice is radically portable. This comes out in the way of life that the monks and nuns led at the Buddha's time. The clothing consisted of three robes. The lower robe that you put around the waist and have a girdle to hold up, the upper robe that you drape around you, and a double robe, which was used for as a blanket, as a tent, as a mattress, and so on and so forth. They had a bowl, which they received when they went begging, they received their food, and they would have a few things like needle and thread, so they could repair their robes or make new robes, which would fit into the bowl. And that was it. That's all they needed. Radical simplicity, which meant radical portability. There's a in the suttas that, because it's an oral tradition, it's all chanted, there's a lot of repetition and rhythm in the chants. So you get these standard phrases that keep popping up again and again and again. And one of them I was reading it once, and it says, "And rising in the morning, the Blessed One took his bowl and his outer robe, and he went to dot dot dot." Now, where he goes to, it could be either he's getting out of the whole country and going on a massive tour, or he's going down the road to visit a friend or have breakfast. But every time, the Blessed One puts on his outer robe, takes his bowl, and goes. Tuk, 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 tuk. Why? Why does he take the outer robe and the bowl every time he goes out? What is... Yeah. He's taking with him everything he owns. He doesn't need to come back. One of the rules is, when you leave your room, whatever room it is, you must leave it tidied up, ready for the next person. Now, the next person might be you 1 hour later, or it might be somebody else. It doesn't matter. Radical portability. So can you imagine living a life that is so free that if you go down to the corner shop or something, you step out and you think, I'd like to go to Perth. Off you go. You don't even bother to go back and look inside the door. You just go. This is the life of freedom that they lived, and the Buddha loved it. He said the household life is crowded and dusty. The homeless life is open. And he loved it. That's why he lived like that. There's another story, and I've never actually tracked it down in a discourse. I was just told it by somebody, but it's so nice I always repeat it. Apparently the Buddha and his students were out in the forest one day doing their thing, meditating, being enlightened, whatever you do when you're enlightened. And suddenly there's a bashing and a thrashing down this path, and this wealthy farmer comes striding down the path, and he's very hot and agitated. He comes rushing up to the Buddha and he says, "Have you seen any cows? I've lost my cows. Did any cows come by you this morning?" And the Buddha, all the monks look at each other. "No, we haven't seen any cows." "Damn it." And the guy charges off down the path. And after he's gone, the Buddha turns to his students and says, "Aren't you glad we don't have any cows?" This story was told to me by a friend of mine. And he said every time his wife got agitated, she would say to him, "Don't worry, I'm just looking after the cows." And the Buddha designed a life with no cows. This is basically what he did, and went to great pains to do it. So his whole approach to the practice was radically portable. Buddhism was the world's first universal religion because it was completely portable. You could take it anywhere, and people did take it. So it went to China, most obviously, through Southeast Asia. It also went to Europe, but it never took off. Too much hostility from the Christians, and because they were getting strong by the time Buddhism got there. But it spread to all sorts of different cultures and adapted itself. And it still is. It still has that capacity. But what the shamans were doing could not be moved. You could only do it there. And only under those special conditions. And so the Buddha is saying, no, there's a much more universal way. So, first of all, the Buddha takes them to a new place in order to teach them. He doesn't teach them back where they're familiar, the place where they're familiar with. He takes them away, and he takes them to an environment which is as different as possible from the one they're used to. So he takes them to the top of a hill. In other words, he's saying, you don't need your sacred places. You don't need them. You don't need the spirits. And then he teaches them a felt intimacy with the elements, which in a sense is what they're doing, but they're doing it through ceremony, through ritual. And he's saying, it's available now, here. It's always available. Feel it. The touch of the breeze as it comes in. The impact of this particular pattern of light and colour as it strikes the eye. The particular smell of the hall. The impact of the particular thoughts and feelings going through the mind. Now, the Buddha, the subject of this discourse is the felt intimacy of the elements through the senses now, wherever we are, whatever we're doing. Wherever we are, whatever we're doing, we are being pounded, struck by the six sense fields, the six sense objects. We are already intimate with the elements, with experience. We don't know it necessarily, because we take it for granted. We forget. But it is already happening. So he's telling them, open up to it. It's available right here, right now. You don't have to do anything special. It's already here. And you notice, as we mentioned previously, of the six sense fields, five out of the six are physical, and only one is mental. This is in contrast to the five aggregates, where four out of the five are mental and one is physical. Now, both of them cover the range of human experience, which is both physical and non-physical, physical and mental. But the sense fields emphasise the physical, whereas the aggregates emphasise the mental. It's a different emphasis for a different audience. So it's the Buddha is putting in place the third leg of the tripod, as it were. This is an alternative way of looking at the human condition, which doesn't negate the five aggregates, but it complements the five aggregates. One is looking at experience from one angle, and the other from another angle. And he begins by saying everything is burning. Now, he's using the metaphor of burning clearly because of their connection with the fire, with the sacred fires, with the fire element, and if there's a fire element, all the other elements are there. Plus, he's talking about dukkha. Dukkha is a central theme. So burning, the burning of of dis-ease, of pain, unsatisfactoriness, and so on. But why does he say everything is burning? Why does he introduce it like that? This is a very important principle. In another discourse, Sabba Sutta, the Buddha says, I will teach you everything. This is the introductory line to the sutta. Now, if you went to hear a Dharma talk and the teacher says, okay, tonight I'm going to teach you everything, then you probably think, we're in for a long night, get a cup of coffee, settle back. But in fact, this discourse is very brief. The Buddha says, and what, bhikkhus, is everything? The eye sensitivity and forms, ear sensitivity and sounds, nose sensitivity and smells, tongue sensitivity and tastes, body sensitivity and tangible things, mind sensitivity and phenomena. So, the six sensitivities and their corresponding objects. Whoever would say, rejecting this everything, I teach another everything, the basis for that would be mere words, and if asked, he could not sustain it. Furthermore, he would become distressed. Why? Because it is beyond experience. So this is the radical empiricism of the Buddha. This is the fundamental principle of his whole approach. What is everything? It's what we experience. There is, for the Buddha, nothing more. It's just. There is just what we experience. Or the process of experiencing itself. Whoever would say, rejecting this everything, I teach another everything, the basis for that would be mere words. What's he getting at? He's talking about doctrines that are not based on experience. Remember when he was talking to Kapatika? And Kapatika says, the Brahmins teach blah, blah, blah. And the Buddha's first response is there any Brahmin who knows and sees? Dot, dot, dot. In other words, is there anyone around here who actually experiences all this? That's his first question. Is this based on experience or not? If it isn't, what is it based on? Well, ultimately, it's based on words. It's just blah, 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 blah. I was just reading an article on religion in China, and one of the quotes, actually it wasn't from any Chinese, but the author's mother, who was raised a Catholic, and he said it was quite odd that even though his mother was a committed Catholic, she said, you have to teach this stuff to the kids because otherwise nobody would believe it. The problem that the Buddha has with certain religions, doctrines, philosophies is if they're not based on actual human experience, then what are they? They're just blah, blah, blah. And we can't rely on blah, blah, blah. We can only rely on what actually happens. So if there's a belief, if you can't trace it to an experience, what is it? It's just words. The basis for that would be mere words, and if asked, he could not sustain it. So there's no proof, there's no evidence, there's nothing to point to. Furthermore, he would become distressed. When people believe something, have a hold to a doctrine which in fact has no basis, what they cannot stand is any kind of questioning, because there's nothing there. They have to say, well, there's nothing, I don't know, there's nothing there. So they don't, so they just get angry, get upset. A classic example in the secular world was just after 9/11, after the planes went into the towers. And so, of course, the world media blazes up with talking about it. And in all the talk, every now and again, somebody would ask the question, but why did they do it? And as soon as anybody would, they would be howled down. You must never ask that question, because it got in the way of the instant orthodoxy, which is, we're good, they're evil, send in the bombers. But as soon as you ask the question, but why did they do it? The whole the whole orthodoxy starts to crumble, so you don't ask the question. When I was raised a Catholic, I used to ask questions. And I asked them out of complete faith, because I was quite convinced that my elders, my teachers, knew the answers. And I was really genuinely puzzled why they didn't just give me the answer, instead they got angry. But now I can understand. This is what the Buddha is talking about. Now, why would all this happen? Because it is beyond experience. The term beyond experience, or what's translated as beyond experience, avisaya, could also be translated as beyond range of the senses. So if there is something going on beyond the range of the six senses that we have, let's say there's an almighty Puba out there, beyond the range of the senses. Let's assume that there is. Let's assume that it's a he, because there seems to be general agreement among the theistic religions that he's a bloke and he likes footy. Why? What effect does it have on my life? If I can never actually make contact with this Pooh Bah, and this Pooh Bah apparently can never make contact with me. Well, some people say, but you can get in touch with the Pooh Bah, and the Pooh Bah does talk to you. Look, his words are in this book. The Pooh Bah, the Supreme Grand Pooh Bah. Here are the words of the Pooh Bah in the book. Okay, so I read the book. Well, I've got visual experience and I've got mind experience. That's what I've got of the book, not of the Pooh Bah. But if the Pooh Bah talks to me, well, I'm back in the realm of the six senses. If I talk to the Pooh Bah, I'm in the realm of the six senses. It doesn't matter where I go, I'm in the realm of the six senses. So, whatever it is that we are looking at or believing in or investigating or whatever, it can only be part of the realm of the six senses. Anything beyond that, if there is anything beyond it, is just completely irrelevant. All we've got is the six senses. So if we talk about the six senses, we are talking about everything. Everything is in the six senses. And this is the Buddha's radical empiricism. Mm. One part of this is that to understand what he's talking about, when the Buddha says X, when he says he's talking about something, whatever it is, what he's always talking about is our experience of X. He's always talking about the nature of experience, always. So, I was having a discussion with someone who believes that awareness is permanent, and it's a common belief in certain traditions. From the Buddha's perspective, how does one know that awareness is permanent? What's the experience of awareness that tells me it's permanent? Well, every time I look, I'm aware. I've come across the book 10 Zen Questions by Susan Blackmore. It's really interesting. The first question is, am I aware now? When we ask that question, the answer is always yes. Always. The next question is, what was I aware of a moment ago? And sometimes the answer to that is, I don't know. Which is very interesting. And actually, it brings out the nature of mindfulness, these first two questions. It's really interesting. But let's say, every time I check, I'm aware. Simply an awareness is permanent. I could infer this, but the Buddha does not. If I tune into something now and then I can be sure that it exists when I tune into it. But how can I be sure that it's there when I don't, when I, in between times? If the Buddha says, when the Buddha does, says that awareness is impermanent, what he's saying is our experience of awareness is impermanent. So usually if people say awareness is permanent, what they're talking about is some ontological something that exists out there, independent of our experience of it. Even if I don't experience awareness as being permanent, still it's being permanent. But the Buddha is saying, look, I'm just not interested in that. I'm only interested in experience. And in my experience, awareness comes and goes. So it's impermanent. So this is where he's coming from. It's not necessarily, the belief that awareness is permanent is not necessarily wrong from the Buddha's perspective. It's just that he's not interested in that kind of belief. He's only interested in what's the experience of it. Do I experience it to be permanent? No, I don't. I experience it to be changing all the time. So everything is burning because everything is experience. Everything burns with the fire of obsession, aversion, delusion. So these are our old friends, the three akusala mula, the three roots of the unwholesome. Instead of attraction, we have obsession. So a somewhat stronger term here. Not so technical, not so neutral, but obsession has got a certain felt impact to it. And whatever feeling arises dependent upon sense contact, whether pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, that too is... burning with obsession, aversion, delusion, burning with birth, aging and death, with sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. You notice how he's grounding it in the ordinary facts of human experience. So this teaching is about the felt intimacy of experience with its emphasis on pain and drivenness. It emphasizes dukkha and tanha. So look at the nature of experience, the impact of it, the felt impact of it right now, and the response to it, we will find tanha, craving, drivenness, and dis-ease, dissatisfaction. That's what we'll find. So if we're looking at the teaching on not-self, this teaching on not-self emphasizes delusion. It's about our basic cognitive error that we make. We think that someone is here who isn't. This discourse is about the basic affective error. We desire what cannot satisfy. So this discourse is focusing on, broadly speaking, the realm of the heart and looking at desire and the discontents that accompany desire. The teaching of anatta, of not self, is about culminates in narrative, as we talked about. The Buddha talks about self in three movements, craving, conceit and view. Craving is about affect, same as the sense fields, the drive. Conceit is cognitive, the sense of separation and therefore identity. And view is not just cognitive, but it's bound up with narrative, with story. And so we see self primarily through the mind. The sixth sense fields is about feeling, not about narrative. There's no necessary story in the sixth sense fields. But there is the immediacy of feeling, the impact of experience. It's about the affective world, or the world defined by affect. So it's more intimate than the cognitive world, the world that we live in our heads, and in a sense more real than the cognitive world, in the sense of its felt power to move us. We are literally moved by the impact of the senses. But paradoxically, it's more difficult to notice, or can be, particularly for us. And there's a greater resistance to surrendering to it. And it's arrived at primarily through the body rather than the mind. Whereas contemplation of not-self, primarily through the mind. Contemplation of the sense fields, primarily through the body. So you see, that's different shifts, different emphasis. So he gave the example, let's take an ordinary everyday activity like hanging out the clothes. From the perspective of an external observer, what's happening? Just hanging out the clothes. From the perspective inside the person doing the hanging, what's going on? Usually what's going on is the drama of my life is spinning around. And we talked about this. We're busily using narrative to create a reality which is a lot more interesting than hanging out the clothes, which seems rather mundane. Like, it seems like I've done this before. So it's quite mundane. If we're practicing the sense fields, from the perspective of that practice, we would be focusing on the feeling aspect of the direct experience of hanging out the clothes. We would be just hanging out the clothes and getting right into its direct sensate feeling nature, feeling quality to it. The reality of it, the smell of it, the dampness of it, the heaviness of it, the brightness of it. This, when we turn our attention to it, is actually very strong. But there's a resistance to surrendering to it because of our habit of losing ourselves in fantasy to reassure ourselves that we're still here and we're still real. But when we're actually in it, when we're actually in the direct sensate experience of something as mundane as hanging out the clothes, it is actually quite powerful. But it's not as, but it's more usually more subtle than narrative, and it doesn't have the same pulling power that the narrative has. But in itself, it's real, and there's a power in that reality. If we're in the meditation practice, let's say we're hanging out the clothes, we find ourselves caught up in thinking, so we might note thinking, we might make the thinking mind the meditation object. Then we would be contemplating anatta, we would be contemplating not self. We would be looking at the way that we construct a self, and in looking at it, we would be deconstructing it. Or we could be noting the senses, simply the activity, the felt impact of the experience, including the felt impact of the experience of thinking, because mind is just another sense organ. So it would be more subtle because the narrative is more gross, or seems to be, because of our habit of getting into it. But there would be, or there is, a very direct satisfaction to it, but not something that easily put into words. In other words, not something easily turned into narrative. It would simply be what it is. But there's a satisfaction in it. Or let's consider the activity of listening to a talk, listening to a Dharma talk. We could be listening to it with the mind busily ticking over, assessing it on the basis of what's in this for me. What can I get out of this? So here we're looking at self being constructed through craving. What's in it? How can I turn this into my possession? And view, how is the way that I see myself in the world influenced by what he's saying? And it's primarily mental activity. Then there's the felt impact of sitting here now in this room and listening, which is different. Have you noticed how it's got darker and the sounds have changed? It's got cooler and damper the time that we've been here. The felt impact of sitting in this room right now is noticeably different from the felt impact when we began. And once we tune into this, it's quite powerful, it's quite strong. But we find it's hard, it doesn't grab us as much as when the thinking starts. But that's our habit. It's not inherent, it's not that this is somehow weak. It's just that our habit is to retreat into the thinking. So the sense that the felt impact of simply sitting here, listening here, this place, this time, is less conceptual, more intimate. And this characterizes the practice of the sense fields. It's just an intimacy with this. And again, most of it is physical, because out of the six senses, five of them are physical. What in the context of the five aggregates, what the mind does is create a sense of narrative unity. The stories are about me, and I am the commentator on the story. In the six sense fields, the mind is the center of sensate unity. All of this sensation is happening here. It's not happening there, it's happening here. And the mind pulls together all of the data, physical and non-physical, and integrates it into one, the experience of a single sentient organism who's experiencing this. When the Buddha talks about contemplating the five aggregates in the texts, what he will talk about, usually, standardly, is to see their impermanence, the impermanence of the five aggregates. They come and they go. This, the perception of impermanence, opens up the door into insight. And it's primarily cognitive. Using the metaphor of seeing, the way we see things. And what is active is insight, vipassana. In this discourse, what is emphasized is the affect contained in the immediacy of experience, the direct felt impact of experience, where what is seen into is not the construction of the self so much, but the construction of pleasure and pain, the construction of drivenness. So the pleasure of the impact, the pain of the impact. So, for example, if we're meditating away, we're lost in thought. If we're sitting there for some time, think, in the fantasy, and then we suddenly notice that the body hurts, is that enough to draw our attention away from the thinking? Often it is. That is what will pull us away. The immediate sense world, its impact is through pleasure and pain. We notice pain and we notice pleasure. Both of these will take us away from the thinking. So when the Buddha speaks about contemplating the sense fields, what he emphasizes is what he calls sanyojana, bondage, the way we're held by pleasure and pain, the way we're stuck on pleasure and pain. So, and that sense of drivenness comes out again in the image of burning, in fire, because a fire has this incredible energy and it's driven. So this opens another door into insight, but this door emphasizes tanha, craving. So the five aggregates, the emphasis is on delusion. The six sense fields, the contemplation, the emphasis is on craving. And in particular, it opens the door into the perception of dukkha, the perception of pain. So, in the contemplation of the five aggregates, perception of impermanence, contemplation of sense fields, perception of dukkha, not necessarily pain in the English, in our normal sense of the word, but dukkha, as we've briefly mentioned, dukkha is an acquired taste. Anything which is not nibbana is dukkha. So dukkha includes pleasure. So the contemplation of pleasure and pain. But pleasure for the Buddha is ultimately disappointing. Ultimately, it disappoints. It's never enough. So if you think of, again, of consumerism, the constant drive for more, people would say, well, there's a lot of pleasure in that. But there must be endless disappointment, because otherwise there'd be no need for more. Otherwise, why would you be driven to get more? Must be disappointed. So it's that quality of disappointment that the Buddha's getting at, which is contained in our relationship to pleasure. So in the six sense fields, the Buddha sometimes talks about contemplating. Specifically, he'll talk about contemplating pleasure. The relationship to pleasure becomes the subject for examination. And he talks about looking at the gratification, the downside, and the exit from what gives pleasure. So studying one's pleasure. First of all, the gratification. What do I get out of it? Secondly, the adinava, the downside that we talked about with Yasa, and he stumbled into this existential downside. So what's inadequate with it? Why is it enough? Or do I want more? Or do I want another one? So what is the nature of this inadequacy and its disappointment that comes with it? And then the exit, the departure from it. And the departure is a cooling down. This is the teaching here is about this sense of drivenness, the sense of urgent necessity that we all have. I've got to get this. I've got to have that. I need this. And that sense of being driven, that sense of urgent necessity in that relationship to pleasure and to pain. And the exit from it is the exit away from drivenness. So a cooling down. The discourse begins with burning, but the aim of the practice is to start to cool down in our relationship to the sense fields. The basic mistake from the Buddhist point of view that we make is we're looking for satisfaction in things that do not satisfy, that can't offer satisfaction, which is why we have to keep doing it again and again and again. The Buddha is not, when he talks about dukkha and the dukkha inherent in the senses, he's not being a killjoy. He's not saying we're supposed to be spiritual, we're not supposed to be enjoying ourselves. From his perspective, we can enjoy the senses, but without delighting in them. Delight is translation of nandi. I think we mentioned this during the first discourse, because it's mentioned in the definition of craving. Craving, drivenness, is associated with obsession and delight. Nandi, delight, is the satisfaction that comes from the gratification that comes from satisfying a desire, which leads to want to do it again. Nandi, delight, is characterized by repetition. Do it again, and 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 again. So we see it most strongly, most obviously, in what we call addiction. Got to do it again and again and again. So this sense of can't let it go, I'm dependent upon it, I need it again, I need another one, I need another one, I need another one. This is what the Buddha sees as problematic with sense pleasure. But we can enjoy the senses without delighting in them. We can enjoy them without seeking from them what they cannot offer. What they can offer is the satisfaction that comes from stimulus, from the interesting stimulus, which is great while it's there. And then when it's gone, it's gone. There's the Buddha himself enjoyed sense pleasures. For example, he enjoyed the pleasure involved in nature. He had favourite places that he would like to hang out in. When he was dying, in the last year of his life, he had struck by a gastric illness and recovered, but realised that he didn't have too much longer to live. And he headed off on his last journey from Magadha. At this point, he was in Magadha, heading north west, probably back to the Shaky Republic. But he never got there. He died at a place called Kusinagara, which is in northern Uttar Pradesh state today. And one of the things that he did on this trip was to revisit his favourite places in that area. And every time he left, he knew he would never see it again. And the text says that each time he would leave, he would give it the elephant look before moving on. Now, apparently elephants are such that they can't look around like that. If an elephant wants to look behind, he has to turn around completely and look. So this is what the Buddha would do. He would turn, he'd look, suck it in, the beautiful sight of a place that he had visited before and been happy in, turn and leave, and it was gone. Finish. Literally, don't look back. Enjoy it, let it go. Let something else come up. And this was his relationship to pleasure and to pain. Suffer it, let it go. Let the next thing come. So there's a relationship to the senses, which is part of this teaching of the sense fields, which has to do with finding pleasure and pain without getting stuck in it, without getting stuck, and therefore without being driven. So one can enjoy pleasure without that sense of drivenness. And this is the maturing of the practice. So That's the first part of the discourse. The rest of it pretty much follows Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. Seeing in this way, the trained cultivated student is disenchanted with eye sensitivity, disenchanted with visual forms, disenchanted with visual awareness, disenchanted with visual contact, disenchanted with whatever feeling arises dependent upon visual contact, whether pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant. This takes us straight back to the discourse on not-self. The two teachings coincide at the point of disenchantment, of no longer being hopelessly infatuated and trapped by the experience. With disenchantment, obsession fades, and from the fading of obsession comes liberation. With liberation comes the understanding of liberation, along with the knowledge birth is exhausted, the highest life is fulfilled, what should be done is done, there is no more becoming. This is exactly the same as the discourse on the five aggregates. So the process of liberation itself is the same. It's the entry in that is different. So in the six sense fields, the entry in is through the immediacy of sense experience via feeling and the response. And the work of contemplation is to study one's pleasure and one's pain, and what one is working with is drivenness, is craving. So one is working with the heart. In not self, way in is working with the impermanence of the body-mind process, but in particular the mind, and seeing through the way that the mind constructs a self, and letting that go, and abandoning a sense of separation from everything else. And the two ways complement each other. But some people will be attracted more to one than to the other. So some people's practice would be more, they'd look more at the mind than at the body. Others would look more at the body than at the mind. Some people would look more at the heart, at the drivenness of the heart. Others would be looking more at the mind, how the mind constructs a sense of reality. Equally, at certain times in one's life, one would emphasize one over the other, for example. Or one could have a very balanced approach where it's just slipping from one to the other. People are different. But the Buddha's presenting two complementary approaches to the nature of human experience and what we do with it. And both the two themes that come out are the cognitive error, the cognitive mistake that we make, the belief that there's someone here permanent, independent of the rest of the world, and the affective mistake that we make, the belief that if only I can grab hold of something, then I'll be satisfied. And these two mistakes support each other. One mistake is delusion, the other mistake is craving. So in any given time, our practice might emphasize working on the cognitive mistake, or it might emphasize working on the affective mistake. If we're working with the affective mistake, the mistake that the heart makes, then working with the intimacy of sense experience, the Buddha is suggesting, would be the way to go. To be simply intimate with experience. And it is very, very simple. As soon as the mind comes in to think about it, it becomes complicated, and it pulls us away from the direct sense impact, and we retreat into a world of concept. Now, even that world of concept has a direct sensate impact. So we're still in the realm of the six senses, but it's much harder to get in touch with. It's easier to get in touch with the body. So, stay with the body. Open to the environment. And this kind of practice actually goes very well with daily activity, particularly in an environment like this, where it's kind of poor. And it helps that it's pleasant. I mean, going to a city and it's got a very strong environment, But usually our defense mechanisms are up because it's too much.
Mm.
But here we got there can be an opening up to the pleasure of it and the pain of it. If there's pleasure, there's pain.
Yeah.
And just radically simply being with the physicality of the experience. This is one way of working with the senses. I think we've run out of time. So that's enough for tonight. Thank you.